A Map of the World, Disc 13.
Chapter 19. I never dreamed that Howard would actually sell the farm, that he could part with the barn and his cows, upon which he lavished what seemed a maternal care. I remember a day long ago when I looked out to see him shining the four-paned windows that are set into each side of the barn near the roof. Our house was falling to pieces and was unclean from top to bottom, and he was polishing the windows up in the haymow, where the dust was thick like haze. It wasn't clear to me that Howard meant to sell the farm, but near the end of the summer his letters became infrequent, short and full of gloom, and to make matters worse, Teresa stopped writing altogether. There was no balance, no yin for the yang. I was mystified. One day she was telling me how delightful the girls were, how much they meant to her, how stoic I was, and the next day there was nothing. A postcard trickled in a week later, saying that they'd been sick, they were busy. I could practically hear her making the feeble excuses, and yet I couldn't think what she was trying to hide. I was writing to her several times a week. First of all, because I was so thankful she was caring for Emma and Claire, and second, because I thought that as well as nourishing Howard, she might be able to keep his spirits up. Teresa's letters were unusual because she wrote just as she spoke, bubbling along about her mother, the girls, the flower borders, an epiphany, a recipe for shortbread. I appreciated her trying to keep me in touch with ordinary life, a place where one fretted over shoddy merchandise and strained relationships. After her communication stopped, I knew that something had happened, and that she, even with her considerable talents, didn't know how to tell me. When the call came through that I could go, everyone stopped what they were doing. They gathered in the day room to watch me pack. Sherry asked me what I was going to wear home, and I described, as best I remembered, the khaki shorts and the gray T-shirt that I'd worn the day I was taken. "You just as well keep the orange shit on," Sherry said. "That sound bland as mud." "You are so lucky," Debbie whimpered. "I wish someone could get me out of here." "You try to keep the faith," I said. "You going back to the farm?" Sherry asked. When I didn't answer, she said, "I couldn't stand to live out there in all that dark, empty space. I'd feel like somebody was looking at me all the time." A woman who was new called from across the room, "Like there ain't nobody looking at us right now?" "Let's not have long faces," Sherry shouted. "You know we'll be back here someday. You know we was meant to be one happy family." Dichette stood just outside of her cell and watched. I gathered my books in the grocery bag and went quickly for the door without any personal goodbyes. It was possible we would meet again, that we might spend the prime of our lives together, if we were convicted of our various crimes. As the door buzzed and the guard came through to get me, I turned and waved. "Be good," I said. "Keep in touch," Sherry yelled. I could see them soundlessly repeating both jokes as I was led along the hall and out a series of doors to the elevator. I felt as I'm sure that dog must have felt. The dog we came upon in our woods one day, wrapped around a tree by its own leash. It was barking and barking. And after Howard carefully unwrapped the leash, and it was free to go, it still stood there, barking and barking. Even when it took one step and another, it couldn't believe that it was no longer bound. It barked at us, at the tree, at itself. It barked as it ran off, astonished all the way through the woods. Before we went to our new town, we stopped at a county park to walk along the nature trails. We didn't talk much, except to point out a turtle, a kestrel, a great blue heron. There had been a short spate of rain, and the trees dripped their water on us. I had missed a season, one dry summer. I had gone in when it seemed the heat would never abate, and come out to find a wet, cool September day. It had rained in my absence. Howard had told me about the first storm in July, and then the few showers that came after. I hadn't heard the thunder inside our pod. The rain hadn't been enough or come in time, and many of the farmers in the southern part of the state had lost their crops. One summer wasn't much to lose over a lifetime, a season blotted out. There might be others to follow in some new place, lush wild summers with cicadas, fireflies, mosquitoes, fish jumping, sunsets, and northern lights. There was no telling where we might go. I felt weightless walking along the trail, as if I might drift up to the sky like a helium balloon if I once let go of Howard's hand. I was standing in the brush looking over the cattail marsh when he told me that school was starting on Monday. There had been a teacher's strike for nearly a month. The girls had seemed so far away while I was holed up, and I had somehow not been able to absorb the fact that Emma was going to be a schoolgirl. She was looking at a nest that Howard had found along the path. I wondered if he'd thought to enroll her at Spring Grove Elementary. We'd have to write down our names and addresses on a registration card, as well as our occupations, our home and work phone numbers, someone to contact in case of an emergency. We wouldn't have much information to give. We had nothing permanent except our tarnished name for that card. I wondered if we had money to buy Emma crayons, a paint smock, a pencil case, a folder, new shoes. I went and knelt down by her, pretending to look at the nest. I won't let her go, I thought. I'll hide her away, or pretend that she's sickly. Howard set the nest back in the thicket. I remembered how lovely he used to look with a small wet lamb in his large splayed hands. He looked tired and unhappy, and I kept glancing at him to see if I was only imagining that he looked so tired and unhappy. It was nice of him to bring me to the park, and I said so. He smiled a lame smile. The girls ran alongside of him by habit now. I was like a guest. I had decided, once I knew about the farm, I had resolved that I was not going to be ungrateful about my freedom. We left the park after we'd had some peanut butter and jelly sandwiches on doughy white bread, the cheapest brand there is, the same kind they served at the jail. Howard occasionally used to make bread with our cow's milk and with flour which he ground from the wheat he'd grown. I used to tell the girls that it was the best bread in the world, and they called it that, the best bread in the world. We stood up and ate because the picnic tables and benches were wet. We were like acquaintances, standing and eating, not quite knowing what to say. Even the girls were subdued, staring up at my bandana. When we finished, we made our way to Spring Grove. We drove into the garage that was attached both to our apartment and to the next apartment in the Pheasant Glade development. Howard unlocked the white door and ushered me into the small vestibule. Never, not in our strangest dreams, would we have seen ourselves in a place so new, a place that smelled as if air freshener were somehow built into the very walls. Howard's jaw was clenched. His eyes narrowed as he moved quickly to open the sliding doors off the kitchen. He had warned me that the place was only temporary, and that it was not something we would have chosen under normal circumstances. He and the girls had picked goldenrod, Queen Anne's lace, black-eyed Susan's, and chicory from the side of a road somewhere, and put them in jars in the living room and kitchen. I sat down in the sagging wing chair we'd had on the farm and took the girls on my lap. I began to talk with them about the time my Aunt Kate moved in with me when I was a little girl, about the day she came to the door with her suitcase, how she'd led me right out into the yard and began planting tulip bulbs. "We'll ask if we can plant some tulips in the back," I said. "There isn't a back," Emma said. "The front, then. That's the driveway." "A window box. We'll make a window box." "I don't think you should put bulbs in a window box. There's not enough dirt in a window box." She was right. "We could color tulips," I ventured, "and tape them to the walls in a border, and then we'll have them all year around?" "If you want to," she said, slipping off my lap, defeat in her knock-kneed walk, resistance in her hunched shoulders. She was choosing isolation. It was all hers as she made her way up to her room and closed the door. "What's under your hat?" Claire asked. I untied the bandana and showed her my very short, soft hair. "You're not so pretty anymore," she said matter-of-factly. "We'll pet you." She nestled into my chest, and I read her blueberries for Sal. When I was finished, she said, "Can we go visit Teresa soon?" "We'll have to call her one of these days."
"When?"
"One of these days we'll give her a call."
"This house is sticky," she said. "I think it smells bad."
I wouldn't let myself think that the unit, as Howard called it, with no space to breathe, was the price we were all paying and paying for my release. That first night, Howard sat me down at the kitchen table in the breakfast nook and showed me his accounts. He was going to be able to pay off his debt to the bank if he could get a job. He had paid my bond, money which we would get back when I showed up for my trial. There was enough to pay Rafferty for the time being, a meager amount for food, insurance, rent, taxes. Nellie would have to wait for her portion. I think Howard was trying to show me that the reason for everything was in the account book. "I see," I said, although the numbers ran together into one big blot of ink at the edge of the page. I'm sure I will never understand what moved Howard. He said that our life in Prairie Center was tainted. It was a defensible excuse, and yet I had always felt, as he did, that the place was ours in a way that went beyond ownership. When Howard farmed, he looked as if he didn't have to do anything much more than pick up a shovel and start digging to be part of the landscape. I don't mean in a pictorial way, but actually a part of it, part of the dirt, the sky, the growing things. Away from home, I had realized that the farm wasn't as dear to me as flesh, but nearly so, that the ground was something that I could very easily have knelt down on and kissed, tried to embrace. Perhaps it was Lizzie's death that had given new meaning to the word ground. It, the ground, the shabby buildings, the shoots in spring, the pond, the garden, began just where our bodies ended. Sometimes his letting the land go seemed as if it could only have been an extraordinary act of kindness, that he assumed the months until the trial were going to be my last chance in a long while to be with the girls, that even Rafferty's reason wouldn't prevail and I would be proven guilty. Sometimes it seemed another punishment for something we didn't even know we'd done. We were sitting on what he used to like to call the Davenport that first night after the girls were in bed. He set his muscled arm around me. It didn't seem to weigh much more than a stick on my back and shoulders. My head was thrumming, something it did when I was tired. I could tell he was nervous. I was going to ask him about the farm, he thought, or say something about the apartment or Rafferty. He was sitting with a terrible erectness and formality. We must have looked as if we'd been positioned like mannequins, as we tried out various topics, all of them running aground before we touched on anything difficult or meaningful. "What about Nellie?" I finally asked. "She'll be back soon," he said. "She always knew you shouldn't have married me," I said lightly. "I haven't told her much. She's pretty involved over there." "We still owe her quite a bit, don't we?" "Yep," he said. "We owe her." We were quiet for a while. "Thank you, Howard," I said. "Thank you." He sprang up before I could finish. "We tried to have a fire one night when it wasn't so hot," he said, looking at the fireplace, "to roast marshmallows. The girls wanted to," he added, perhaps to make it plain that there wasn't much he wanted anymore. "You can hardly get a log in the grating, it's so small. What'd they make the thing for if you can't use it?" "It doesn't matter," I said. "But what'd they make it for?" I followed him up the stairs to the master bedroom. I wanted to lie down with him and cry or laugh or be sick, shivering under the covers, partners in misery. He had put the futon on the orange-flecked carpet, the old lump we used to haul out for guests. Our clocks were there, the Big Ben and the Little Ben, ticking away as always, both of them keeping the wrong time. From storage, Howard had pulled together a box of essential things for me, not unlike jail basics. Underwear, socks, T-shirts. I was trying to think what to say beyond thank you when he said, "I'm tired. Could you get the light when you're done?" I climbed in and he turned over and kissed my cheek, mumbling something about how much they had missed me. When I was sure he was asleep, I crawled out, pushed open the sliding door, and stepped onto the rough planks of the small deck that faced the highway. The air smelled of fry from the bar and grill down the street. It wasn't the chintzy carpet, the newness all around, that made me feel that I'd just been born and had neither a past nor a sense of the future. It wasn't the streetlight shining in over the bed, or the fact that we didn't have one speck of dirt for a tulip bulb. It wasn't any of those things that made me feel as if I had cracked. I got back under the blanket and tried to pull close to Howard. He was asleep, and his jaw was still clenched. He found a job at the motor vehicle registration office that's right next to Shopco on the outskirts of Racine. He had to take the civil service test, and the fact that he scored off the charts temporarily bolstered his spirits. He gave people eye exams, did the paperwork on title transfers and registrations, and processed driver's licenses. His starting salary was $21,000 with benefits. It was the most he had ever commanded thus far in his life. He stood at a booth like a bank teller all day long, and was courteous and helpful. They told him that if he stayed a year, he'd most certainly rise to the rank of team captain. I had become maudlin, sentimental, as temporarily bright as a new penny. One of those oppressed and hideously cheerful Victorian children heroines, Sarah Crewe or Pollyanna, kept a running list of reasons to be thankful. Emma and I had a notebook where we wrote down the good things that had happened to us. Howard's success on the job market was the first entry in our book. It came as no surprise to us that Emma was reluctant to leave home in the mornings and go to school. At 8:20 every day, Claire and I walked her to her kindergarten room in the old schoolhouse that had high ceilings and tall windows and a musty charm. We left her in the hands of Miss Smucker, promising, crossing our hearts, hoping to die, that we'd be waiting by the door at 11:36 when the bell rang. I hated to promise on the off chance that I might get carted away. I had come to think while I'd been in jail that I deserved to be there, a normal reaction, Teresa later assured me. I couldn't see a squad car go down the street without thinking that I'd better hurry and get my things. After we dropped Emma at school, Claire and I used to walk to the playground. We'd swing, take the trip down the slide, and then head over to the A&W. We always split a sweet roll and had a glass of water each. She prattled on and on, and I'd close my eyes and listen to the pure sound, the cadences of her 3-year-old speech, trying, somehow, to etch the music into my brain. Not long after my release, Teresa called, saying that she was so anxious to get together. I remember thinking that it was both a curious and appropriate word choice, anxious. I hadn't yet felt ready to talk to her. I wasn't ready to feel so vividly as I would in a meeting, the void. Teresa may have begun somehow to adjust to Lizzie's death, but my time in jail hadn't made me know more deeply that it was real. She suggested that we meet for breakfast on a day 3 weeks away. It seemed so agreeably distant, far enough in the future, that it might never come to pass. But the morning arrived, and Claire and I stood on the sidewalk outside the A&W, waiting, knowing from experience that she'd be late. When her blue van came along the block, I wanted to run, and I had to breathe hard to get an adequate supply of oxygen. And I had to hold the metal outdoor menu post to keep myself from giving in to the old habit of fleeing. As she turned into the driveway, she stuck her head out the window and called. "It's so great to see you!" She rolled up onto the curb and rocked back into the parking space. "God!" she cried, trying to untangle herself from her seatbelt. "It's so good to see you!" She turned off the engine and jumped to the pavement, talking as she hugged me and talking as she held me at arm's length. "I like it. I like your hair. It's so comfortable. It's chic. Did your long hair get to be too much? You look younger. It makes you look like you're about 20. No, honestly. Come on, Audrey, honey. Come see Claire." She stooped down. "Hi, Claire. Give me a hug. I've missed you. Audrey, do you have the little present you were going to give Claire? There you go." "God, Alice," she said, taking hold of my sleeve. She hadn't really looked at me yet. She was buzzing and flapping, all movement and noise. "It's good to see you," I managed. We admired the children and expressed astonishment at their growth. Inside, the girls went directly to the play corner, where they had old-fashioned desks and a pot full of coloring books. Teresa settled herself into our booth, first smoothing her skirt over her rump and then sitting down. She leaned forward and said, in an undertone, "Can you believe what happened? Aren't you still in shock? Sometimes I just can't believe it. Sometimes I say to myself, no. I just have to say no." At first, I thought what was different about her was her new feverish pitch, her record-breaking speed. Other than that, it seemed as if she was rattling on in a regular old way. She was working 20 hours a week, she said, and no more, because she meant to devote herself to Audrey. You can't get the time back, she said, looking at her menu. She was going to have her tubal reversed at the beginning of November, with a doctor in Milwaukee who had a 90% success rate. Dan was making an effort to be at home more, and they'd been planning a lot of family activities. I've got my hopes pinned on a baby, she whispered. Maybe I shouldn't, but I do. We'll heal faster with new life. I just know we will. I said how nice that would be. I could see by the way she kept turning the pages of her menu without reading that she wanted to move away from the subject of Lizzie. Lizzie was near. We both felt it. As we talked of increasingly smaller and smaller things, the thick, hovering form of the little girl became more oppressive. Teresa, understandably, would certainly have rather been at home. She wasn't quite engaged, going through the motions of breakfast and friendship. When our food came, and we had the business of eating to preoccupy us, she casually asked, "Will the whole deal take up your time now?" "I think Rafferty's trying to leave me alone for a while," I said. He was so angry at first. Howard didn't tell him about the farm until after the closing. Rafferty always maintained that the property was our anchor, our greatest asset. It proved we weren't going to turn tail and run. Howard went over to the office the Monday morning after I got home to break the news. I've gathered that Rafferty gave him a dressing down. Paul and I talk details and stay away from the farm issue. I think he's worried that Judge Peterson is going to be against us. He's always very reassuring, but all the same, I know he thinks that the judge might bar our key witnesses. Oh, God! No, I said. I don't worry much. I've always, from the start, felt that the thing just had to play itself out, that Howard and I are only two of the many powerless players. She sat across from me eating her bacon biscuit with the sort of intense concentration that's required for taxes and higher math. She had her head bent over the plate, and she chewed as if she was inspecting her food for something that might better have been observed under a microscope. "I've struggled a lot lately to keep from feeling helpless," she finally said. I nodded, knowing that it must require tremendous energy to keep up her unfailing good cheer. I nursed my coffee along, staring out the window, and she continued to work at eating. We had suddenly and unexpectedly fallen into a silence. We had run out of material, gone dry. We used to tell each other the kinds of private stories I had never planned to tell anyone. We didn't know how to start up again. We didn't know what to say. The silence had descended upon us like a hex. "God," she said for filler, shaking her head. I racked my brain trying to think of something that didn't point to Lizzie. Later, I came up with numerous topics we could have spent hours belaboring, but at our booth, I was sure we had lost our bearings, that we had somehow forgotten crucial information about each other. We both went at our breakfasts as if we were actually hungry. When we were finished, Teresa cleared her throat and wiped her mouth carefully, and I blew my nose. She picked up a sugar packet and read it, and I motioned Sharon, the waitress, for more coffee. "Those girls sure are busy," Sharon said. "Yes," I nearly shouted. "Aren't Claire and Audrey doing a good job?" "Oh, they are," Teresa cried. "They really are. They are so good." We turned to look at them over in their corner, sitting at the desks, scribbling in their books. Emma always used to play with Audrey. Claire was the one who had been Lizzie's friend. I was really impressed by how well the older girls included Claire when they were at our house, she said. Alice. Oh, Alice, was it awful in there, in the jail? We had come through. We had passed the doldrums, found wind for our sails. I shook my head first and then nodded. I don't know. I laughed at my own confusion. I read a lot. There's a poem, No Worst, There Is None. Pitched past pitch of grief, more pangs will, schooled at four pangs, wilder ring. The last line, too, especially spoke to me. All life death does end, and each day dies with sleep. That sounds good, Teresa said faintly. I'll have to look it up. One of the funny things I finally figured out, I said, was that the need for stories was so elemental. The jail girls could turn the smallest happening into something supernatural. Oh, God, Alice, she groaned in her good old way. Any longer in there and one of us would have turned into a top-notch orator, a little Homer, a Homerette, reciting the long list of inmates as if they were ships going to battle. I put the warm coffee cup to my cheek. I'm still pretty disoriented. I'm mixed up about the whole experience. Of course you are. Take Sherry, I said. The one I told you about who was driving the getaway car. She was 19 years old, had two or three children. At first, I thought of all the girls as wayward kids. But by the end, I realized that Sherry, in particular, had a dignity, a nobility that I will never have, no matter if I live to be 90. I don't even know how to talk about it without making that nobility sound like some ridiculous racist stereotype, the noble savage idea. I don't know how to talk about them. Maybe there isn't any way to talk about them. Even Dyshet, the other girl I wrote you about, tried to bridge what seemed to me an infinitely wide, an unfathomably deep gap. When I was in my do-gooder phase several years ago, I used to think I might volunteer at a prison, tutor someone toward their high school equivalency test. But now I don't see how I could teach those girls anything they don't already know. Can you imagine having to take them through something like the Boston Tea Party? She said, laughing. All of that seems so irrelevant to street kids. I started to tell her that that wasn't exactly what I meant. What they need is life skills, birth control, nutrition, that kind of thing, she interrupted. I don't know, I faltered. I think Dyshet would have understood, no worst, there is none. We ate some more. Everything had changed. I had been carted away. Her daughter was still dead. We no longer lived close by. I might end up locked away for the next several years. I had been naive to think a friendship could be maintained on a different plane from circumstance. I should visit them, I said, but I'm not sure I could face it. I'm working up to sending them something, a care package. Give it time, Alice. I feel you don't have to ever visit them. You don't have any obligations to those people. Obligation, I said. I don't understand the first thing about obligation. Howard's mother called the other night. Alice, dear, she says so sweetly. How are you? Fine, I say. Bear in mind that I haven't talked to her in almost 3 months. 3 tumultuous months. She says, could I speak to Howard? He's been in a sweat for weeks because he hasn't heard from her since he wrote her about the farm. We owe her so much money. The failure to pay your mother back is one of those primal failures. I listened while they talked, and he kept saying things like, "That's great, Mom. It sounds like you did a good job over there, Mom. We're fine, yep, the girls are terrific." When he hung up, he looked as if he'd been run over, back and forth. I was sure he'd pull up his shirt, and there'd be these great tire marks going every which way. I used my arms to demonstrate the random course of the four-wheel drive that had flattened my husband. She covered her mouth in that delicious, familiar way of hers and laughed in spite of herself. Nellie is relieved that our farm adventure, that's what she calls it, she's relieved that our farm adventure is over and that now Howard can get a real job. Isn't it fantastic how little she knows him? She knows nothing about him. Maybe I'm the only one who can really know that he'll never be as happy again as he was with his barn. His barn with the beautiful, clean, four-paned windows up in the dusty haymow, and down below, the golden Guernseys chewing away on their cuds. Teresa turned her head, and I went on quickly to spare her the embarrassment of her tears. She had always been one to cry easily, an ability I had at times envied. "But back to obligation," I said. I would have thought that Howard was obligated to tell me that our children were being interviewed by the police. He mentioned it recently, as if it was nothing. He told me after dinner, by the way, I was incensed. I couldn't get him to say more than a few monosyllables about it. No big deal. The girls could have been put into foster care. No sweat. I asked him if he was trying to punish me by not talking about it. He looked at me uncomprehendingly. "It was short," he said. "The girls were fine. It lasted 5 minutes. It turned out to be nothing." "I think he was wanting to keep you from worry," Teresa said. "I suppose. But it feels like, well, like something on the order of betrayal." We didn't talk too much longer after that. She said we should get together more often. I said I was pretty busy with the trial coming up. I didn't have transportation either, so it was hard to plan for anything more than 5 blocks from home. "I'm so busy too," she said. "It's just terrible." When she was buckling Audrey into her car seat, she asked, maybe to prove that we actually did have more to talk about, that we hadn't exhausted our subject matter, "How is your place? Is it all right?" "It's incredible," I said. "That's great." We made the obligatory embrace, and she leaped into the van, turned it on, and promptly backed into the dumpster. She smacked her palm to her forehead and laughed. I watched her go, wondering why she had called in the first place. If she needed to see me because she had been well brought up, because she felt it was the nice thing, the proper thing to do. We had survived the breakfast, and we had found, after the slow start, that there was enough to say. But standing on the curb, watching her fly off, I felt the oddness of it. The compulsory meeting had taken place. It had felt stylized, like a kabuki version of a woman's breakfast. There wouldn't, in the future, be much reason to see each other. I bought tubes of paint with money from the change pot, and to Howard's horror, I painted flowers at waist level all around the living room. Perhaps the pheasant glade life was what I was secretly yearning for back in the old days when I used to get mad at Howard for dragging us into the dairy business. He didn't look like himself in his dark blue dress pants, his light blue shirt, his crimson and blue tie, and his dark blue jacket, the official uniform of the motor vehicle registration worker. Sometimes it seemed that he could hardly stand to ask me for the smallest thing, that it was difficult for him to get out the words, Please pass the salt. I bought Emma some clothes at the Goodwill store. And with Vaseline, I polished up a pair of patent leather Mary Janes that I'd found at a rummage sale. She's a very particular child, and I was grateful to her, another for our list, for not turning up her nose at most of the things I put in her closet. She had grown up over the summer, grown up and gone into her own world. She spent a lot of time lying on her bed, listening to books on tape from the library. She couldn't yet read herself, but she listened to Heidi, the Little Princess, and Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, over and over again. She didn't want me to read to her anymore. In the evening, I'd lie on the floor or on the bed and listen with her. Sometimes I'd fall asleep and stay there all through the night. When I was small, I used to listen to my tape in the dark, to my dead mother reading Little House in the Big Woods. I used to try to believe that she was sleeping right beside me. Chapter 20. The leaves in the park turned color and fell, and we walked through them, scooped them up, pressed them flat in the dictionary. Emma found a kitten, and I agreed to take her in, which overnight changed the smell of our unit. We had long since forgotten what it was to have a weekend, and we were taken by surprise by the sheer fact of Friday, by the prospect of liberation. Even Howard's heart finally temporarily eased at 5 o'clock every Friday evening, at the thought of 2 blank days. We had the habit of getting takeout fish fry from the bar down the street. Howard usually managed to jam a log in the fireplace, and we'd sit on the hearth with our dinners on our laps, watching the flames. Over the course of the fall, we went to Old World, Wisconsin, and watched women make butter and spin wool. We went to the Science Museum, the Art Museum, the Lakefront, the movies, the Botanical Gardens, the Children's Museum, the State Capitol, the Train Museum, the Circus, and the Wax Museum. Howard was a working man, and I spent his money without thought of tomorrow. What we were experiencing, I believe, is called motion. I watched us in the reflection of the store windows in downtown Milwaukee, Howard pushing Claire in a stroller, Emma and I, hand in hand. We looked fine. We looked like perfectly regular people who were having a weekend. At the end of the day, we always came home exhausted, hungry, the four of us snapping at each other. I warmed up the brand-name supper the girls insisted upon, Kraft macaroni and cheese, and hot dogs to go along with it. They ate noisily with their faces right down in their bowls. Howard read the paper over his peanut butter and jelly and carrot sticks. Because of his job, we not only had major medical insurance, but we also had dental insurance and ocular insurance. We had never before been so secure, so prepared for failure. The trial was set for December 2nd. At the end of October, the three boys, Anthony Jenkins, Norman Fraser, and Tommy Giddings, dropped their charges. The whole story was like a carefully wrought pile of sticks, and it was Norman who began pulling out the supports at the bottom. He made half the structure cave in. He apparently started naming everyone at school, saying that the gym teacher had put a gun to his head, the art teacher made them drink paint, the classroom teachers put aside numbers and letters in favor of what sounded like satanic rituals. When the investigators tried to pull him back to the original perpetrator, he remembered nothing that he had said before. Anthony Jenkins had also been giving inconsistent statements, and it was determined that his story wouldn't hold up in court. The Giddingses decided that it was going to be more damaging to Tommy to have to testify than the already substantial harm that had come to him, and they reluctantly withdrew the charge. The older children who had been assessed were said to have grievances which would have required disciplinary measures by the school and termination of my contract if they'd come to light while I was still an employee. They weren't serious enough to warrant criminal charges. My case, then, was a small one, contained after all. It had been front-page news for a few weeks at the beginning, and later was occasionally found near the back of the paper, a short paragraph about the trial again being postponed. If I had a meeting with Rafferty, I'd take Howard to work, and in the same shopping center, I'd drop Claire off at Happy Haven, a daycare that had previously been a fashion bug store. Claire didn't mind the atmosphere of commerce, the fluorescent lights, the shiny linoleum. She had a friend named Brianna, and she loved the applesauce that was white and came from a jar. She was the family member who had been serene before and had remained so, who seemed to have come through unscathed. I waited, watching for signs of disturbance, for sleeping or toileting problems. I wondered if there was something wrong with her, to have been so untouched by our troubles. It seemed strange at first to walk on my own power to Rafferty and Finn, to climb the stairs to what had once been a bedroom, and sit with Paul in his mess. He was good about explaining what he meant to do in the trial. "Think of it this way," he said. "The prosecutor's case is a dot-to-dot puzzle. If she connects all the dots, she has a beautiful picture of a guilty defendant, and she gets her conviction. My job is to mix up the dots so that no clear picture emerges, so that there is a jumble. My job," he said, making mock diabolical hand-washing motions, "is to sow seeds of doubt." We sat on the sofa and he scrawled on his paper, showing me some of the things he expected to get out of the witnesses in his cross-examinations. Under Robbie's name he wrote, "Provoke him, by my mere presence, to be disrespectful and rude. Show the jury he's a temperamental, unreliable, violent kid. Ideally, get him to admit he's seen Mom in compromising situations." "Are you sure?" I asked. "We have Mrs. Sheridan. Wait until you see her. You are going to love Mrs. Sheridan. If Judge Peterson denies me Mrs. Sheridan, I'm going to lie down on the carpet and bang my head. I'm going to file appeals until we get Mrs. Sheridan. Mrs. Sheridan is going to be our star witness with higher billing than even you. I'll never forget that day I knocked on her door and she looked up at me with her runny eyes as if I was the angel of the Lord." I said, "I think you're having fun." The Paul Rafferty I had known when I was in jail, the fatherly, concerned man who would restore my life, occasionally let down his guard in the privacy of his boudoir to reveal a slightly effeminate character, an eccentric who was in no way embarrassed by the pleasure his job afforded him, who was concerned but not preoccupied with the player's pain and suffering. "Of course I'm having fun. I wouldn't be any good if I didn't have fun, you know. The kind of fun a person has on Outward Bound, killing yourself so that afterward you feel great. That's what we're talking about here, the kind of travail that brings reward. However, a work such as Mrs. Sheridan is more than fun. It's downright exhilarating, like hauling in the prize fish. You don't get a witness like Mrs. Sheridan hand-delivered more than once in a lifetime." He adjusted his tie, put his hand on my shoulder, affected his sober father expression. "I'm not having fun at your expense, Alice. Is that how it seems? You can be sure I'm enjoying the prospect of getting the real story out. Susan Dirks is going to be doing a lot more homework on the next sex abuse case she takes, and so are the investigators, I can tell you that much. we're shedding light into dark corners, into places most people don't go. I am always respectful of serendipity in my cases. And if I am having fun, it is only in isolated moments, getting my kicks where I can. I've had my share of disappointments in this case. You know the score. I've had a hell of a time getting a hold of the boyfriends. And the one we needed, the primo beau, doesn't want to cooperate. So we do the best we can. You have to realize that it is the judge who will shape the outcome of this, depending on how he sees it. I could be brilliant. Susan Dirks could be the genius prosecutor of the century. If Peterson isn't on our side, it doesn't really matter how good we are. He told me that often in cases like mine, his hardest decision was whether or not to have the accused testify. "There's no doubt here," he said. "We'll put you on last. We'll leave the jury with your honest, forthright, and indignant denial." I had several sessions with Rafferty in which we rehearsed his direct examination. And then a friend of his, a lawyer named Ross Grile, cross-examined me, firing dirty, abusive questions, one after the next. Rafferty had filed a motion asking the judge to prohibit any cross-examination on the subject of Lizzie's death, because it wasn't relevant to the case. The accident would serve, he said, only to inflame the passions of the jurors. Judge Peterson had written a stern letter to both Rafferty and Susan Dirks, granting the motion, and instructing both of them to keep their witnesses from including Elizabeth Collins in the testimony. When I answered Ross Grile's questions, Rafferty would say things like, "Yes, yes, beautiful," and "Deliver it with more punch, Alice," or "You have talent, my dear." Once he said, "You look like Audrey Hepburn in that movie where she plays the blind girl. You know the one I mean? Wait until dark. Helpless, so pure and unsuspecting. The audience knows the killer is in the room and she is saying so sweetly, 'Is anyone there?'" When I thought I might lash out at him or cry, when I protested that I did in fact feel that I was on location, Rafferty said, grand in his humility, "I'm sorry. I'm terribly sorry. I'm getting carried away because I know you, because you're my friend, because we share certain sympathies. I'm very sorry. You have to understand that this is where it comes together. We're getting down to the last few pieces of the puzzle. It's intense, I know. You'll do fine. You're doing just great. You're wonderful. Say, Ross, do you remember the time you tried that guy for rape and the girlfriend had the monkey? No, it was a parrot, wasn't it?" I'd leave them to remember their early glory days. Sometimes I'd walk over near the jail and I'd look up to the fourth floor, wondering if they were all still there. I'd go so far as to slip inside the courthouse and study the trial lineups, the arraignments, the motions, the hearings, to see if any of them were on the schedules. Afterward, I always made myself go outside and sit on the steps. I had a ritual. I had to stay put for so many minutes and think of them. Think of what TV shows were on, how many card games they'd been through. I had to put my time in, sitting, as if it was church. It was silly, I knew, to think I was doing them good by having a moment of silence in their honor. When I'd done my small penance, I turned around and drove away from the city. I picked up Claire, and if there was time, we went in the motor vehicle registration office to watch Howard guide illiterate customers and old ladies through the paperwork of title transfers. For the first time in their lives, the girls had an old-fashioned Halloween. They got to walk through the town streets in their disguises, trick-or-treating. They opened their bags and strangers dumped candy in, telling them they looked precious in their St. Vincent de Paul kitty costumes. No one ever used to come to the farm for either pranks or sweets, and we had managed to keep Emma and Claire in the dark about the treat aspect of the holiday. In Spring Grove, you could take the candy to the hospital to have it x-rayed, but we chose instead to rely on blind faith. When we got home, the girls poured their stash onto the floor, drew a circle on the carpet beyond which no others could come, and began to eat and trade and eat. Howard and I didn't have the heart to stop them, and they neither turned green nor got sick. They seemed healthy, peaceful, happy, drowning in sugar. Nearly a month later, we solved the dilemma of what to do for Thanksgiving by all of us, one by one, coming down with the stomach flu. Nellie had invited us to Minnesota for the long weekend. I don't think she really understood that I was going to be standing trial days later for something that could put me away for years. I don't know that Howard had ever fully explained the fact that I wasn't allowed to leave the state. "Could you tell her we need family time right now?" I asked him. "Could you say it's been a confusing season and we need to have a day alone?" "Would it be possible for you to come to us?" I heard Howard say to her on the next call. "We've got the sofa bed in the living room." That alternative wasn't what I had had in mind. They phoned back and forth, and she finally settled on driving to Spring Grove early Thursday morning, bringing her homemade cranberry sauce, and making stuffing when she arrived. Emma got sick on Monday. Claire went down on Tuesday night. It was only a matter of time before Howard and I capitulated. He was stricken on Wednesday, and I held out all the way to Thanksgiving morning. "It's your fault," Emma said to me as I squatted by the toilet. "It's your fault that Grammy can't come for dinner." When I came downstairs mid-afternoon, the girls were on the floor putting together a puzzle that Teresa had sent them, and Howard was sitting on the sofa staring out the window. There were a few saltines in a package on the kitchen counter, a six-pack of 7-Up, and in the refrigerator the thawing turkey and the makings for coleslaw. I shut the door quickly, plunging the big dimpled bird back into darkness. As the trial got closer, Rafferty predicted that it wouldn't last more than a week, two at the outside. When I sat through the jury selection and then the trial itself, I tried to hear a melody, to find a sense of music in that mournful room. The story was so old I was quite sure there had to be music running along somewhere, through the benches, up through the heating ducts, out of the worn woodwork. I once tried to explain my feeling to Rafferty. I tried to say that despite all of his careful tactical maneuvering, in spite of his knowledge of the rules, the new rules, the newest rules, there had to be something lyrical in the game, had to be something on the order of music. "I don't quite follow," he said, looking mystified. "Music?" My head was hurting quite a bit back then, and I could only put my hands to my crown and wonder if something had, in fact, come loose. "No, I like that," he said after a minute. "I'll have to listen. I like that. Music." The day of the trial, I closed my eyes at the sight of the jurors filing in. There was already a feeling of weariness in the courtroom, and if, as I had hoped, there was music to be heard, it was the slow, occasional twang of a music box winding down. Rafferty had said that there were conflicting strategies for choosing jurors for child abuse cases. Some lawyers believed that women were more sympathetic to children. Some believed, as he did, that senior citizens didn't generally believe that adults were capable of abusing children, that a child's testimony often seemed preposterous to them. Rafferty also thought that men were more tolerant of abusers. Although I had sat in a pretty dress watching the interminable selection process the day before, it was quite different to have to watch them move in together. They seemed connected, something on the order of a centipede in the school play, minus the blanket thrown over them. At first glance, they all seemed to be aged, overweight, stone-faced. They wanted to be in their beds, in front of their televisions, crocheting, fishing, anything but this at the end of their lives. They slumped down miserably in their chairs, as if they thought they were going to have to do something unpleasant in a few moments, something that required exertion. When the testimony began, I was able to observe them, sneaking looks periodically, and they soon came to be individuals, to have definite personalities. But as they settled themselves that Tuesday morning, I found myself turning to Rafferty, grabbing his forearm. "What?" He cocked his head so he could hear my complaint. "They don't look equal to the job," I whispered. "You'd be surprised what people can do," he said. 8 times out of 10, they rise to the occasion." I swallowed, believing. Judge Peterson sat up at his desk, reading and biting his nails. He had the thick, dark hair of a youngster, but his face was deeply lined. He looked as if he'd grown old prematurely, as if he'd prefer not to hear another cross word, as if his job no longer taxed him, but instead only irritated him. My future was in his crabbed hands, and I tried to look as if I trusted in goodness, the way Teresa would have if she'd been in my position. Howard was taking unpaid personal days to sit behind me in his handsome suit. That suit, which had proved so useful, was another thing for which I was grateful. Nellie had been right. It was important to have one garment you could count on for certain occasions. I had dressed according to Rafferty's specifications. I had taken the last $160 in my checking account, and at the Laura Ashley store in the mall, I had purchased, on sale, a light pink angora mock turtle sweater and of a yellow skirt with small pink and blue flowers. My hair had grown out to a point where it could have looked corporate chic, but Rafferty didn't approve that style for me. "As vulnerable, as feminine, as soft as you can get that butch cut to look," he said. I combed what there was back from my face and secured it with a pink velvet headband. I had thought there might be a crowd at the proceedings, but when we came into the courtroom, there were only a handful of Blackwell women. Rafferty reminded me that Christmas was coming and that people were busy. "They've gone on to consume other things," I said. "Yes, that's about the size of it."
This ends Disc 13.